Welcome back, everyone, to the Op Show, where we bring you the trials and tribulations, the automations and collaborations from the world of DevOps and the greater developer experience. I'm your host, Tristan Pollack, and as always, with the CTO.ai founder, Kyle Campbell. In our best show yet, we have Noah Labhart, not Lambert, not to be confused with the famous country singers of our age, the CTO and founder of Variable, as well as the podcast host of Code Story. An amazing podcast that dives into the behind the scenes code from a lot of startup founders. Noah, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thanks for the Lambert check there in the beginning. I certainly appreciate that consideration.
The Lambert check.
You nailed
check.
It. Yeah, totally nailed it.
I'll make sure to put that down as a hashtag for the show, Lambert check. Yeah, tell us a little bit about your story, how you got into working on startups, how you started the podcast would be great and really interesting to hear about both of those and to kick us off.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I spent a lot of time in the corporate world before I jumped out into entrepreneurship. Worked at Alcon Laboratories for 8 years, did the tech IT thing, learned a lot, was well taken care of, but always had the entrepreneurial itch. I just wanted to jump out and do my own thing. Have a lot of family members who have their own businesses, and so it's kind of in my blood a little bit too. And so in 2015, decided to jump out. My extremely beautiful and supportive wife agreed that we could leave all of the benefits of corporate America behind and give this entrepreneur thing a shot. So we did and jumped out and started an agency, a mobile dev agency ran that for a few years. Started out as just me and ended up growing it to 15-ish contractors that worked with me on different projects. And it was really great. Got to build startup solutions. And after doing that for a couple of years, I was like, I want to build my own startup solution. I want to do my own product, but I don't have any ideas. I'm not the idea guy. I'm the executor. So I networked with a few of my friends, was like, hey, if you know anybody looking for a tech founder, let me know. I'll at least talk to them and see if it's a good fit. And so my old college roommate, Rylan Barnes, who is also a tech entrepreneur, hooked me up with my current partner, Mike Kinder. And we started Variable in 2016, launched it in 2017. So that's where that all started and kind of been doing startups.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about Variable too and what you're doing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Variable is an on-demand marketplace for manufacturing labor. So we're the Uber for the shop floor. Everybody has an Uber tagline, so that's ours. So we provide businesses with the opportunity to capitalize on flexible labor. So be able to ramp up and ramp down their workforces on the shop floor, in the distribution center, along the supply chain, ramp up or ramp down based on their demand. And we give workers the opportunity to work for multiple companies, create their own flexible schedule, and get paid every day. So that's what Variable is.
Awesome. Yeah, seems like something that is needed more and more, especially in this time and age of people having to move in and out of roles or with furloughing and people getting sick and the craziness that is COVID. How have you been seeing the reaction like with the manufacturing space and your business?
And also what got you started in that space? I mean, that's an interesting space to go from mobile to manufacturing.
Sure. That's an interesting question. So I'll answer that one first and then I'll go back to COVID for Tristan. So on that one, I worked as a college kid in a manufacturing plant, so on the shop floor, packaging up insulation, actually fiberglass insulation, which I would not recommend to anyone doing because it's an itchy job, but somebody's got to do it. And so I did it for a summer. And then at Alcon, when I worked in the corporate world, I supported manufacturing for 3 or 4 years. On the shop floor at two different plants, actually, from a technology standpoint. So I knew the environment. And when I met Mike Kinder, my partner, his idea was around on-demand labor, was around enabling that flexible capacity to be able to enable manufacturing to step into this new era of technology. And he's been in manufacturing for 15, 20 years or so, working as an operations manager in shop floors, as a consultant, doing a bunch of different stuff. So he came and pitched the idea. Having done some time in manufacturing and having built startup ideas, I couldn't shoot holes in it. And so, bang, here we are a few years later and doing the thing. As far as the, you know, kind of COVID and what we've seen happen, it's been interesting. You know, I think everybody was sort of knocked flat with COVID in the beginning. We were able to continue retaining all of our employees and still remained a pretty flat revenue trajectory. So it didn't, we were growing and then we kind of flattened with COVID.
Okay.
Yeah. But then after that, after the stimulus money started running out, people had to start working again. And they jumped back on the platform. So we've actually seen our biggest month yet, this past month in August, and are continuing that upward trajectory.
That's very interesting.
Oh, that's great to hear.
What's your take on generally manufacturing in the US? I mean, I know that was a big issue in prior elections. I'm from Canada and don't have that much of a context for it, but obviously like manufacturing, stateside manufacturing is a pretty big subject. And I would think that that's probably a driver of what would be your major or sort of market. But I mean, is that an incorrect assumption? And what are you seeing as far as manufacturing as a whole in the industry?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to watch it sort of unfold now. And it is, you know, we're focused on the United States, at least, you know, for the foreseeable future. And, you know, bringing manufacturing back stateside has been something that's been obviously of interest to us, that topic of, you know, it's, we, you know, focus a lot on making sure that we are politically agnostic. We are economically driven, and we are, you know, focused on creating value for the businesses that are here. But, you know, we look and we do understand the manufacturing environment. We look at people that did in the past offshore their, we'll say offshore, but move their operations to different countries, to different, you know, places to do their manufacturing. What we've seen is that it doesn't really save them that much money, and it creates a lot more problems than it improves. So we see a lot of people coming back. We see a lot of people bringing operations back to stateside, which helps us because then there's more manufacturing individuals to work with. Mm-hmm. And people that are in new operations as well are much more open to using this sort of third labor paradigm, which, you know, there's full-time labor, there's temp staffing, and then there's us.
And what's sort of the incentive for them there? Is that sort of to help them manage the all-in kind of increase on OPEX around labor costs in relative to cost of living, obviously, in America?
You said the incentive to bring it back?
Well, the incentive maybe to use your platform as a driver as they're bringing it back. I mean, beyond just the efficiency, I mean, I think one of the main reasons why people obviously have always offshored is cost center. And then there's these sort of what I call opportunity costs or the hidden costs of offshoring, or, you know, looking at that lower cost of subsidizing, you know, your operations. So I think obviously if they are bringing it back, you know, what they're dealing with is a higher cost of living in many cases, I would assume. And do you guys fit into that paradigm as part of the value proposition? And they're saying, hey, look, with this paradigm, we're driving a greater deal of efficiency by bringing on demand labor so we can have a higher quality of what we're producing. But that's because we're staffing it more, intelligently.
Yes. No, you're exactly right. So bringing it, so we do fall into that paradigm, and we want to be a part of that value prop of bringing it back, right? Because what we offer is, you know, basically manufacturing plans their capacity based on averages, right? Okay. It's like, okay, this is what we think our demand's going to be. So we're going to average it and think what, you know, our average labor capacity should be. And that's what we're going to staff up to full time. Mm-hmm. Right. And as your demand goes up, which everybody wants their demand go up, you want your sales team to kill it, right? You want to have more orders than you know what to do with. But then that becomes an operational problem. Either you can hire more full-time people, which is expensive and an administrative burden, or you can bring on temp staffing, which you don't know who you're going to get. You potentially, and most of the times, get poor quality workers, and you have to commit to a certain time period. Mm-hmm. Where we come in is that we allow people to work with on-demand workers, work with people in discrete amounts, get them familiar with their operation, build up kind of a favorites list, what we call your labor pool, people you've worked with, and then be able to bring them in and let them, not let them go, but basically as your demand falls, their work, you know, ends, so to speak. And then you can essentially ramp up and ramp down your workforce just in time, like you would inventory or like you would, things of that sort, or web servers.
To drive analogies to the DevOps and technical domains. I mean, there's peaks and
valleys. Elastic labor.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. That's very interesting.
That's the goal and that's the idea. And a lot of the long-term dreams that we have are hooking into enterprise software and being able to end-to-end automate that based on real-time orders. So bring in orders. We understand your metrics of your operation. We can calculate your on-demand labor needs, post that to our marketplace, and people just show up as your orders come through. That's the dream. You know, there's a lot of things in between all that we hope to solve. But that's the dream.
Wow, it's even more now analogous to the things that we're trying to achieve with the Ops platform than I even realized. I mean, really what we're trying to do is create this concept of a workflow, which is almost like, you know, a component of your manufacturing chain, allow you to drive context into our system. And we're not really looking at it from a perspective of how we help you deliver on-demand staffing, but we're more saying, hey, here's how you can then bring that context into those conversations. And obviously, you're going to make the decisions about how you hire. And there's nuances there, obviously. I mean, I think manufacturing, you're looking at a longer time horizon, and software, you know, sprints are typically more shorter iterations and more persistent. You can never build fast enough, right? Whereas I can see in manufacturing, there's more of this sort of scale up, scale down based on seasonality or market demand or, you know, the actual quality of the product that's being received in the market. It seems like it's likely more volatile, therefore driving a better use of your product. My question is, like, what are some of those things that you are currently instrumenting? I mean, you're saying that you'd like to be able to tap into, I assume, like Salesforce to gather sort of the top of funnel information, but around the fulfillment and the delivery, are you instrumenting anything around, you know, even hardware or other aspects of the, I guess, supply chain?
Yeah, not really. So we are, you know, we're not looking at Salesforce. You mentioned Salesforce. We're actually looking at enterprise systems. So we're building, our point of view is we're building a way for a solutions architect to essentially go into a manufacturing operation, tap into their ERP or their MES or their, you know, WMS, LMS, whatever the system might be, pull in real-time information, pull in real-time work metrics around their operation, and then we take that and calculate their on-demand labor needs. Mm-hmm. So you know, tapping into those types of data sources and then running it through our system, popping out the types of work that they need to our marketplace, and then automatically filling workers from that point. So we're not touching in hardware, we're not touching in the actual operation.
Right.
We're trying to situate ourselves in digital factory and industry 4.0, the buzzwords around manufacturing, where we sit as one of the apps and connect horizontally and vertically in that ecosystem.
Yeah. And I assume there's less cloud adoption in this market either way. So you're going to have the challenge of dealing with probably less consistency in what you integrate. Therefore the enterprise architect, am I following? Okay.
That's correct.
These enterprise architects, I mean, that seems like part of the big fulfillment challenge or implementation challenge, right?
Right. So we're kind of in this middle weird time frame where enterprise software is drifting towards the cloud, but they're not there yet. Right. People are trying to, you know, and I don't know they're ever going to be fully cloud, right? For a lot of these enterprises, it's going to be private clouds, right? It may be off-prem, you know, storage or off-prem systems, but it'll be private clouds.
Why do you think that? Is it just too big of a leap, or is it okay?
It's too big of a security leap, from what I can tell. Yeah, it would be great if they did get to that, because then the ecosystem would be a little more pure. But I don't see everybody wanting. I don't see everyone having the champion on their team to do that, if that makes sense. You got to have the person that's on the team that's like really believes in going fully cloud-based solution. And with some of these bigger corporations, this is just not. it's not there yet. It's a longer play. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the systems, the enterprise systems are drifting towards the cloud. So some systems were able to connect with or could connect with in a much easier way. But when we get to the point where we're, you know, connecting with enterprise systems that are on-premise, right, that it's going to take a solutions architect to be able to pull that information and push it out to our system. And that's where we look for, you know, implementation partners like consultants and, you know, like say like PricewaterhouseCoopers or KPMG or things like that to go into these operations and say, this is how you win with variable. You hook up your system and you do this engagement with us and we essentially automate your end-to-end labor needs.
So they drive the fulfillment, the consulting, and you've just worked out sort of these partnership arrangements to them where you're a vendor and they're your sort of ISV, as I understand the terminology.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's interesting, like if we went the other route and didn't have these integration partners, we would essentially be trying to create connectors for every system, right? And that makes a lot of sense for, you know, SaaS solutions out today. You got integration, you know, you guys are big on integrating into Slack, you know, right? And integrating into all kinds of third-party systems, right? But for enterprise systems, it's just not that way,
yeah.
Right? And even for cloud enterprise, system, so it would require that that on-prem architect, and we don't want to go be the kind of connector. We don't want to kind of pick and choose who we think the best connectors are. We want to build our API and say, okay, you are our implementation partner. You go have this engagement and connect to their systems to ours.
Makes sense. Let you be more of a platform, serve a broader base of the market without zooming in on every single, you know, domain that is maybe not high context, high value for you.
That's right.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah. It is interesting to see like a lot of the comparisons, and Kyle and I were just talking about the supply chain comparison, yeah, of the real world to the software world and what fits and what doesn't.
I chuckled.
And Kyle had a bunch of opinions on that.
Yeah, well, this is a great example. Why, Tristan, right? Because, like, you know, when we saw this ad by, you know, I won't call them out, but somebody in the sort of like DevOps space, and they're like, your supply chain. And like, you know, we've taken these terms from manufacturing, like agile or, you know, Kanban or what have you, and we've tried to take mm-hmm. these ideas and bring them into software. But I just kind of laugh at it sometimes because it feels very self-important. In the regards that it's like trying to reinforce this idea of complexity for complexity's sake. And it's like, you know, really in software, I feel like you should be thankful, especially in cloud-based systems, you should be thankful at the ease of integration, the ease of being able mm-hmm. to develop. And that really just doesn't exist in the manufacturing world. So to take their terminology and apply it to the space that we're in, I don't know. I have a hard time with it because, again, I think it feels self-important in some way that isn't genuine to the realities of how wonderfully easy it is to build software in many yeah. cases, right? Never before have I seen, I guess, like a more literal example than what you're exactly describing that you help your customers with, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing how easy it is to integrate software, but it does, when you start to get in the world of atoms and trying to shift people around too, not even just physical stuff, hardware, machines, it's people. Your eyes are open to how good you got it,
right?
when you're integrating software.
I'm yeah. sure there's lots you can learn though as well. I mean, and that's probably the core thing that I do subscribe to with that, those sort of like parallels is like, you know, the more we can learn about manufacturing and then, you know, draw from it on an accelerated time frame that software offers, I think the stronger you're able to transpose that ideology into the new era. And I really like, I don't think that those analogies are wrong at all. I mean, mm-hmm. I think a big part of how we're thinking about software is like the next era of how manufacturing has been built. And that's pretty much the premise for everything we've learned. I just think we sometimes discredit how easy software actually is relative to hard manufacturing and the kinds of things that were happening during, you know, more industrial eras, right?
Yeah. Yep. That's good stuff. Yep. I think everyone should go spend a summer on the shop floor. It'll really open your eyes to a lot of different things.
Yeah. I could say I've never worked any kind of marketing or manufacturing job. So that's maybe something I should do. But I think, especially for engineers, it's a really powerful thing to look at, you know, I guess less modern software and go back to this idea of like, you know, where engineering came from and hard delivery around hard items and timelines that are exasperated so that you have to make really good decisions because over 3 years, those decisions play out and you're right or wrong. Whereas in software, you can ship an MVP in 30 days and be like, all right, scrap it. Which, you know, I know that's something that you subscribe to. We've talked about this in the past around thinking about an MVP, how to build an MVP, how to stay lean. Would love to hear a little bit about how you think about that, how your team has approached that, because it's clearly a competitive advantage, right?
Right, right, sure. No, that's, the way we approach software is we ship fast. I mean, we're developers, we want to ship fast too, but from the very beginning, we focused on building a tight core product, right? And I think that aligns with, there's a lot of our internal values that align with manufacturing and building a tight core product, something that's going to work that you can build on top of is extremely important. That's something that we have done. So you look at a manufacturing line, right? You got to get the line right, and then you can add on to it, right? You can get your automation engineering team to add in a SCADA system or add in a quality check or adding X, Y, and Z, right? But it has to be really good at the core of the product, and that's the way we approach building our platform. And you know, sometimes you got to go in after certain times and maybe not gut the thing, but change the foundation a little bit, right? You got to go in and, you know, we're working through changing our monolithic architecture into microservices, right? Which, you know, everybody's got an opinion and a story there, that's what we're doing. And that's, you know, essentially changing our tight core product and it's what it's standing on. So we're doing that in a very diligent way to make sure that it's correct. And it's not, doesn't mean that it's perfect, and it doesn't mean that we don't ship as quickly as we can, but it does mean that the ideas that we've built the company and the product on still have to maintain true when we're doing even building a microservice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that I really like about that is we get into this idea of doing it right in software. And I think it's because we look at things over such a short time horizon where, you know, 3 years ago, a monolith was the right thing to go. And now it's, you know, microservice is the right thing to do. And I think truth is like neither one of them is necessarily right. I think it kind of depends on what you're trying to do. And I think mm-hmm. like early on, a monolith is really great. One code base, less overhead of configuration and management. That's getting your assembly line figured out. Then as you start mm-hmm. trying to optimize and isolate aspects of the delivery pipeline, or the manufacturing line, you're sort of optimizing, and that's where you start to have the opportunity to break things out and encapsulate them in services so that you can separate concerns. And I think, you know, really there's sort of this journey that you go on, and I call it DevOps over time or software development over time, where, you know, the decisions that you make early are not the same decisions that you want to make later. But yeah, I think you sometimes we get confused with the idea that the decisions later are the right decisions early, and they can be, but it's also not to invalidate the idea that a monolith is not the right thing, because it's a smaller footprint, less overhead for you to be able to configure and deliver. You get that line set up, and then you start figuring out what are the things that are working, what are the things that need to be rewritten. And I think when you start looking at more of these like hybrid models, or even like a progressive model or an evolutionary model of how you build software, I think it opens up a wide world of strategies that you can use to really manage risk in how you implement, but then also accelerate towards right faster, because you're bearing the benefit of not taking on too much of the overhead of assuming you're right early.
That's right. Yeah, that's good. That ties back to something else sort of that we sort of believe and have worked on, is using unconstrained models, like starting out doing something in an unconstrained way and then constraining it as we know more. Right. You know, it's interesting. You talk about monolithic to microservices and how unique it is to a solution too. That's where Code Story comes in for me. Like I think every week I have a different conversation with the founder who's done it in a different way. And some people have, you know, taken their monolith to model based microservices, and some have still have a monolith and they're serving millions of people on a monolith and it's working great. Some have half a monolith and a few microservices and they don't know when they're going to get to the rest of the transition, but they're doing business and it's awesome. So it's really interesting to see how unique people's perspectives and execution is on that specific thing.
Yeah. Best programming language is the one that you can use, is what, you know, some people say. I think there's a similar kind of a viewpoint that I've seen emerging, and I've had some discussions with founders or people, you know, I had a discussion with TJ Hollowchuck about this on Twitter, where there's sort of a similar bifurcation of like, do I bootstrap? Am I an indie dev or do I do VC? VC is bad because wasteful money. But you know, one of the things I started coming around to this year, especially since we bootstrapped and now are also VC funded, is after reading Blitzscaling, the book by Reid Hoffman, I sort of realized that, okay, well, it's actually more like you want to bootstrap early because you're pre-product market fit and you're not trying to accelerate because you're probably wrong. And then as you start to be right, you want to accelerate quick because competition is a bigger threat. And so I think this decision-making, whether it's technology or building businesses, and I also think there's like cross-cutting concerns between the two of those examples that make it even more complicated to understand. But I think this is where, you know, strong decision-making relative to the dynamic landscape of what you need is important. I think that's one of the things that having a strong CTO, you know, really brings to the table, is that intersection of like these technology compromises with, you know, business decisions and when do we go fast and when do we go slow. And, you know, what's the right strategy for that now? And what's the right strategy for that later? And how do we not shoot ourselves in the foot in the middle? Because we still got to pick this up and bring it over there, right?
That's right. Yep. Yeah. It's still like kind of operating on just-in-time needs, right? You're aligning with the business needs. You're building technology to meet that business need. You're getting it out fast as soon as possible. You're building as right as you know at the time. And you're doing the right thing at the right time, which could be, you know, could mean building the right feature, but it also could mean, you know, I don't know, undoing something, some technical debt that you had built in the very beginning. So, and it's all relative.
Yeah, it is. It really is. So tell us about how Code Story started. You know, that's been a great podcast where I'm sure you've heard from many different, as you said, many different CTOs, and probably learned a diverse set of things about how people look at this. I mean, how did it start? And, you know, what are you learning from it as you release more and more episodes?
Absolutely. So yeah, Code Story, it's, as you said, is my podcast, interview startup CTO founders. So it started and I released the first episode in June 2019. So it's been a little bit over a year now. It started out, I was a podcast junkie and still am. So can't refute that. I listened to How I Built This by Guy Raz. And when I found that podcast, I ate it up.
It's just every
episode. Yeah. He does such a great job. So, you know, he and his team, and I think it's part of NPR too, he and his team does a great job with the music and the narration and the creation of a engaging story. But the way that he interviews the people are also really interesting too, because it feels like you're in a coffee shop with him. And he's like, whoa, wait a minute, what? I'm going to ask this question, right? But he's doing it on purpose because he's trying to draw out some tense parts of the story and then later on resolve it because he's good like that.
Yeah.
So I loved that podcast and I was like, I want that, but I want it for tech. You know, I want it for tech people. And there were some podcasts out there that did a good job, but there wasn't really anything that was a production. There wasn't really anything that took the music and really tried to create a tension in the story that did some narration. It was more kind of interview based. So I was like, I had some friends that started a podcast and I was like, they look like they're having fun. Maybe I'll try to do it myself. I've got a music background, so I know audio, I know how to record, I know how to do all that stuff. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to give it a shot. Recorded my first episode with Rylan Barnes, who I mentioned earlier, and kind of got his story there. And so, you know, we did the interview. He came over to my house. We did it, you know, we were supposed to do like a 30, 45 minute interview and ended up going 2 hours. so we had 2 hours of roll to go through. And then I got to editing and it took me 6 months to edit the first episode.
Time to revise that manufacturing process, right?
yeah, that's right. And finally I was like, okay, I'm getting in my own way. So I hired an editor. So I had an editor for the first two seasons. I'm back to doing it myself for season three, but first two seasons I had an editor that really I worked closely with on the music and the story. And I finally got out of my own way. It's like, I just got to get content out there and learn how this works. And finally did that. And so we launched the first episode. We were doing it every 2 weeks in June of last year. And then now we're doing it every week and actually do multiple a week now if I have extra content. So wow. It's been really fun. And what I'm learning, I mean, I learned so much from people and the way that they approach problems. I learned so much about being a tech human, you know, because I really want to draw out those human stories of like, what did it feel to have to fire that person, you know, or what did it feel to choose that technology early? right? And then realize, oh crap, I got to rewrite the back end now because that framework's not going to work anymore. And so, you know, just kind of getting to share those experiences with them. I learned a ton about myself, about them, and about, you know, how people solve problems.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being on it and then listening to it. It definitely gave me that Guy Raz, but it also, the other thing that it reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever listened to any of Gimlet's productions, but they did one specifically, mm-hmm. one of the early ones. It was called Startup or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was like a season. And then the second season was like a separate second season. And what was cool about that one is it drew out all those raw pieces like you're talking to, but they also followed someone through the journey. And I think that's one of the things that often gets missed sometimes is like, you're almost always looking back in retrospect, but for them to show the almost like the time horizon of how much suck you can go through in a, in that journey and just like, and still come out the other end with something very interesting. I thought it was very compelling. It was a little bit more documentary style, I guess, which was a very interesting format for it. And I wish we saw more of these things that are drawing out that those, you know, not necessarily those painful things, but it's only, you know, the things that people overcome because it's so valuable, from a learning perspective for the people who are coming up. I mean, it's not like you learn this stuff in university, right?
That's right. You don't. You learn it from networking or just being in the trenches and getting hit and getting back up.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. It's a good perspective. And I think it's, you know, this kind of like it's went from like storytelling to like journey telling a bit, especially with startups. And you've seen this in, you know, with what you're doing and indie hackers and there's, you know, platforms just kind of promoting this. What's happening behind the scenes? You know, what is it actually like, and, you know, really being able to follow and like build community and empathy and compassion around it, which is a really cool, you know, revelation now in today's like modern working world.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Where do you go with Code Story? Do you tend to sort of keep it grassroots, sort of non-advertiser based? Do you think it turns into something bigger? Like what, in your three seasons in, is it for the love of the creation, or has it got bigger legs? Well, what's the ambition with it from here after three seasons?
You know, that's a great question. And honestly, Kyle, I'm trying to figure that out right now. it's definitely for the love of the creation for two reasons. One, cause I love the artistic part of it. It's a nice little like, side project for me. And two, it's for the love of the artistic expression because the advertising market sucks right now. So I did, you know, did early on kind of take on some advertising at different episodes, and that helped kind of pay expenses when I had an editor. Now I'm doing it myself, and so I don't really need that. But where it could go, I mean, if I could get the exposure that I want, I would love for it to blow up because I think that people would like it, and I think that I've gotten some good feedback. That people do like it. So I'd love to share that with them. And, you know, if that could turn into a monetary thing, cool. If it could lead to some other, you know, like opportunities, that's cool too. You know, it's not really for making money right now. Although if it did, that would be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in worst case, you've got this huge network of, you know, really smart people who you've been able to understand their stories, learn from, and then likely that I figure if you just keep on the path you're going. I mean, the network effects of opportunity driving opportunity is always, you know, I mean, that's the only reason you came to the Op Show is that we connected over Code Story. So there you go, right? We'll just keep that one rolling and you'll be present.
Totally. Okay. I was like, I need to talk to this smart guy, Kyle, right here. I need to talk to him and I need him on my show.
Appreciate that.
It was a great episode.
I like that too.
Yeah, that's basically, I mean, what happened to me is, you know, I talked to Kyle and I was like, okay, I need to work with this guy.
That's Jeez, right.
Now I get to talk to him every day.
How's that going for you?
I learned something new every day from Kyle. And so it was well worth it.
Yeah, I feel that's like awesome. That's the benefit of these sorts of community-driven episodes. I mean, you know, we did the one podcast and we weren't that involved in the production of it. You know, Miyuko was driving it and we sort of had a production company that was supporting her with it. And, you know, it was great to see the network of people that they brought in and the caliber of network. But we really have had a different experience, Tristan, I think, with this show and getting to talk directly to people like you, Noah, and just learn. And like, you know, often I come into these very much without too much of a plan or too much context. Obviously, you know, we've talked before, so I have a much better context for you, but it's incredible to me the stuff that we just learn on the fly from talking. And you know, we're tempted to make it more structured in some ways, but to be honest with you, it's almost like these ad hoc insights where we're just exploring it is one of the driving value propositions of it. And yeah, it can be a little bit long-winded at times, but you know.
Yeah, it's about, without the preconceived notions and it's, yeah, it's almost become this, like you were saying, Noah, like kind of a coffee. We're just kind of like riffing, but we're recording it and then sharing it. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, those types of conversations are really valuable, right? Like if someone could, you know, is a budding entrepreneur and, you know, they see Kyle, right? They see Kyle on LinkedIn or something, like, I'd love to go have coffee with Kyle and bend his ear. Well, that's what these kind of conversations are, right? It's like, oh, well, yeah, Noah, Tristan, and Kyle sat down and bent each other's ear on, you know, how to do all this stuff. I'm sure there's some nuggets in there that I can take away as if I was sitting there with them. So I love it.
Let's zoom in on Noah then here.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
So even you've had these great, you know, stories talking into the technical side of all these businesses. You know, what are some of like the takeaways, the trends, like some of these learnings that you have been hearing and, you know, whether it's just stuck with you or you've seen it repeated on different episodes?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've been thinking about that a lot, and I've been thinking about putting together kind of like the learnings episode, right? And just pulling stuff out of all the conversations. And
Reid Hoffman has some really good versions of that on his podcast that I think is probably an awesome archetype for that, where I think it's the 12 commandments or whatever that he does. Mm-hmm. And he's pulling all of these amazing pieces from all of the individual episodes. I'd get really jazzed with that if you did that, actually.
well, stay tuned. Yeah, okay, we're bullet pointing the episode right now.
Cool.
So yeah, I think that in general, I'm amazed that everybody's story is a little bit similar and everybody's story is very different. I've talked to a lot of people that have started on one back end but have rewritten their back end a year or two in, which is, I always found really interesting because I've had to go through that. It can be really, really painful and really disruptive. So I thought that was really interesting. When it comes to team, everybody's sort of looking for the same type of person. They're looking for someone that's going to think a little bit entrepreneurially, that's great, that's going to be able to figure things out on their own, that's going to be able to sort of like self-teach. And think about it from what the perspective of the company, which seems obvious, but it is still hard to find sometimes. So that's that part. I've been really surprised by how scalability's gone all over the map. So we talked about, you know, monolith, microservices, things like that. But some people were required to introduce like kind of a microservices or a really highly scalable solution in the very beginning, as opposed to others that are like, you know, I threw it into a WordPress site, or I, you know, used a parse framework, which I did that. And you know, it's really interesting that that's all over the map. But other things are not, like team and like, a lot of the MVP stories are slung together, and you know, we got it barely working and it was ugly and we shipped it anyway and it didn't feel good, but we did it. And so yeah, I mean, you know, that's a little disorganized as far as a response, but I'll keep going. I'll get that episode going.
Yeah, I think that one would be awesome. Great. I'd love to get sort of that macro level view, because I think there's things that are those things that are consistent, I think they're universal, not just even within the technical spectrum. It's in the broader kind of like foundership and entrepreneurial spectrum. It's like people is kind of like, you know, like it's all about people. I feel like sometimes technology is just so subjective, you know, that it's hard to rationalize around a certain set of things. And it's also something that, like, I don't know, my view is like, I'm going to be wrong about. So I try to build that into whatever I do. And I think that's where you get different perspectives. And I think that might be driven from experience. You know, people who have more experience have a different set of ways that they weigh the equation of solutioning something, either because they've been through the pains or they've had the wins, hard to say. But I think it's, it's really interesting. And that's where, because it's so subjective, the more that you can put out there, I think that creates this feedback loop on the first thing, on the team's thing, because I think a lot of the disconnect for, why it's hard sometimes to find that person, that archetype that you said everyone's looking for, is that that experience isn't accessible. And I think the more people have been through, you know, what we used to joke is the death march in my agency days, you know, you're working the weekends and you're doing what you got to do to get it out the door. You're shipping it and you're like, darn, if I had to just spend a little bit more time investing my innovation tokens into things that mattered, you start to make different decisions. And so I think the more you can expose people to those stories like you are doing, or even we're trying to do, I think the more it shapes that perspective. And ideally, the more people who are able to see their technology solutions through that lens. And I think that's one of the primary roles of a CTO is to bridge that gap. But I think the scale in which you can do it with your episodes and the learning that you're amassing from people is just on a whole level, a different level of impact for, you know, people who are on the up and coming, you know.
Right on.
Good work, man.
Thanks. It's fun. And you know, it's cool. It doesn't feel like work. It's fun.
Let's talk a little bit about your guys' tools and technology. Obviously you've learned so much. So, you know, let's unpack Noah a little bit. Noah's team. You mentioned you're using Parse, but like, how are you guys setting up your software delivery? Let's talk a little bit about the tools. How do they integrate? You know, what's worked, what hasn't, you know, what have you thrown away? I would love to just see now, as you have that macro level view, how it's impacted your own practices with your team.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's a good question. How organize those thoughts in my head. So we're not on Parse anymore. So we started out building the MVP on Parse. We launched on Parse. And then we quickly got off of Parse, because we outgrew it. You know, Parse is node-based, Mongo-based, and it's a framework. And it worked great to get us up and running and get a proof of concept. But if we wanted to do any sort of analysis on our data, we just couldn't use – we didn't feel we could use Mongo to really get it done. So we ended up rewriting our own backend from the Parse world into a node-based solution and then using Postgres. So that's where we kind of introduced our own monolith, right? Built that monolith. We sat on it for 2 years, I'd say, two-ish years before we started to see performance issues. You know, we use Heroku, and AWS, which Heroku is a little more expensive.
Is that
obviously
AWS for RDS, for Postgres?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. AWS for RDS. And then Heroku for all our servers. And then we started to see, you know, performance issues primarily on the RDS side, but a little bit on the Heroku side too. And we were just, you know, in a good problem to have. We had so much activity on the platform that it was starting to cause performance problems. We're like, okay, this is great. We've arrived. Now we got to solve this problem. So, you know, where we're moving towards is more of a microservice type architecture. We're using Kubernetes and containers. What are we using and to organize? I think we're using Kafka to do our internal messaging, but between all of the services. For the messaging, but then service mesh, we're using Istio. Still using RDS, but breaking that apart, we're moving from Heroku to AWS to get fully off of Heroku.
EKS or something like that, the Elastic Kubernetes Service. Yeah,
that's right. Good. That's right. So we're pretty jazzed about that. Kind of at a high level, that's it's getting to the point where I know less than my team does. So I would probably have to pull them in if we wanted to get any more in the weeds, which is a good place to be. It's a weird place to be for me, but it's a really good place to be when I have such an amazing team.
Yeah. What about source control and sort of like CI/CD? Are you guys on GitHub, GitHub Actions?
Yep.
GitHub,
we don't really use Actions. CI/CD, we're using CircleCI.
Cool.
What else are we using? I feel like there's some other things kind of in the middle of that, but I don't remember. CircleCI is our primary one.
Cool. Yeah, they've been really, you know, like gobbling up a lot of the market. I think what we've heard a lot about and use a lot of Actions, and I think there's still just a lot of things that are kind of missing there that people are asking for. And, you know, and I think Circle CI is ahead of that. You know, what about like at the Node.js level? I mean, you obviously are started with a monolith and then we're moving towards services. Is that just pretty vanilla Express that you use, or are you using some sort of framework for how you think about the service-oriented architecture?
Yeah, I we're using Express. Cool. So Express, yeah, so it's pretty pretty wide open as far as there. I think we're open. I think we're open to, if you've got any suggestions, I think we're open to that. But yeah, that's the kind of the route we're going, sort of slicing off, you know, obviously our high throughput services and trying to maximize or optimize is a better word, how we, you know, right size them, how we process data, things like it, the same thing everybody's doing with microservices.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Express is a solid choice, and I know there's people out there who may not, but I mean, I got into Express very early on. You know, thank you, TJ, for creating that personally. You know, I think I disagree a bit with our VP, our new VP of engineering, Luca, on some of this. He's really keen actually on something called Fastify, which is a different framework. I haven't spent that much time with it, but I sort of went into Express, really loved Express, got involved in something called Feathers, which is essentially like a service-oriented framework that you plug into Express. Yeah. To basically just give you very easy RESTful APIs. And, you know, probably like you, I spent a lot less time in the code as of recently. And so I defer a lot of these, you know, what good decisions are to Luca. I know he's really excited and the team's really excited about Fastify. A lot of talk of things like gRPC, you know, Google's RPC framework. There's a gentleman I met recently named Peter. And Peter has started a business called, I think it's called buff.build, BUF.build. And it's essentially all these tools around gRPC. And you know, I can't really state with any authority, but what, you know, it's the murmurs I've been hearing and somewhat coming out of the enterprise space is kind of that HTTP's dead, gRPC's the future. I'm like, oh no, more tools to learn. Can I just have Express? I mean, there's such a spectrum of things that you can implement. I really like your stack because I think it's practical. It makes it quite easy for you to hire and train up and enable your talent.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, there were some compromises as you decided to go from Heroku to Kubernetes. And one of the things we hear a lot of times from teams who adopt things like Kubernetes early or the cloud native ecosystem is, you know, about the challenges that they're potentially going to go through, or that they do go through as they deal with the, you know, the idea that of Kubernetes, which is, you know, a platform for building platforms rather than like a fully baked SaaS. How did you guys think that through and rationalize that? And what kind of changes did you make sort of as a technology exec to kind of try to set yourself up for success with that journey?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I would, to get really in the weeds of where we had to go through the transition, I'd have to bring my architect in, my lead architect, Andrew Plan. We should have him, I'm not a part of your show. You guys should have him on the show for sure. I'd love that. But no, how we thought about it at a high level was, you know, This is what we've seen that makes sense. We, you know, we had some conversations with some friends, a CTO of a company called Alto, which is like subscription Uber, we'll call it. And it's in DFW. I think they're deploying into California too, given the new AB5 stuff. But I talked to him and his name is Jonathan Campos. And he is a Kubernetes nut. He's a Google fanboy, has been an architect for a long time. And he kind of explained the way that Kubernetes worked and the way that containers would work with pods and everything. And it just made sense.
Yeah.
So when we decided to move forward with a solution to go away from monolithic and to go into something a little more elastic, we went with what made sense, and that is what made sense to us at the time. And gosh, we're still learning every day as we do this. And I think there'll probably be times where we're like, I wish we'd have known that last year. Now we got to change something. But for now, it's still what makes sense to us.
Yeah, it's a big ecosystem, lots to learn, and still lots ahead of us. Well, cool. I think we're just about at time.
Yeah, we're just about out of time. Any last thoughts, Noah?
This has been super fun. I mean, let's do it again. I think I'm super excited about some of the new stuff that Kyle, you were mentioning. I can't wait to hear more about it.
Yeah.
You mentioned the pitch, so I'm ready for the pitch. Cool. And it's just been super cool. You guys are doing great work.
Awesome. Where can people find you online? I take it your tagline, Tristan.
You know it too well now.
People can find me at, so if you want to learn about me, my website is noahlabhart.com, not Lambert, labhart.com. And then if you want to learn about Variable, it's variableops.com. And then the podcast Code Story is codestory.co.co or on any major podcast directory.
All right. Sounds good. Well, that's all we have time for today. It was a pleasure, Noah. Remember, for all the audience out there, to click subscribe to never miss any of our weekly videos. And post any of your favorite parts in the comments or any guests you'd like to see on the show. I think for this week, we'll give away a piece of free swag for some of the top comments. So let's see what happens. And that's it for the op show today.
All right. Thanks so much, Sean. That was a great one.
Thanks for having me.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.